Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Welcome to the latest edition of The Yield. I'm Rishi Dixit, Chief Technology Officer at Yield Street, and I'd like to welcome you all to today's webinar. I'm going to talk a little bit about fintech, where it is, where it's going, what are some of the challenges. Quick information about Yield Street, please feel free to visit www.yieldstreet.com to learn about our offerings. And if you're an originator, do check out our Raise Capital page on the website or send an email to originations@yieldstreet.com. We actually have a live offering that just launched or is about to launch, supply chain financing offering 2E. Do check it out. We also have a couple of real estate offerings currently open, Park City Luxury refinancing, as well as a North Virginia office financing deal. So do check those out. So we're going to chat a little bit for about maybe 30, 35 minutes. I'd love to introduce you to our guest today, Noah Labhart, who is the CTO and co-founder of Variable, a really cool startup in the gig economy space. He's also the founder and CEO of TouchTap, a digital solutions studio, and the host of a really cool podcast called Code Story. So welcome, Noah. Thrilled to have you here.
Oh, so pumped to be here. Thanks, Rishi.
So we're going to chat a little bit about fintech. Please feel free to have the questions keep coming in. We'll try to get to as many as we can and also leave a little bit of room at the end to have some live questions as well. So just to kick it off, I'd love to hear a little bit more about you, Noah, your background, your journey into technology and entrepreneurship, and just your overall experiences that have brought you here today.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again for having me. This is super fun, super honored to be here, and love the work that you guys do at Yield Street. Yeah, I've been in tech for about 15, 16 years. I started out in the corporate world doing .NET development, slinging some C#, ASP.NET stuff. Then went to full-on corporate America and worked at Alcon Laboratories for 8 years. Was treated really well, learned a lot of really great stuff, got some school paid for. It was a great place to be. But I started to get the itch. I started to get the entrepreneurial itch, right? A lot of my family has started their own business. It's kind of my blood to do our own thing, kind of, you know, maybe not have a floor, but have no ceiling either, kind of work as hard as we need to kind of thing. So started to get the itch, started to want to see a little bit of fruits of my labor. And with the huge support of my amazing wife, we decided to jump from corporate world and start my mobile development agency that was TouchTap. Started that in 2015 and then did that for a few years and started building startup solutions for people. Then I got the other itch, which was I wanted to do my own startup. And so started going through that process, got introduced to my current partner and started Variable, which is an on-demand marketplace for manufacturing labor. So we're the Uber for the shop floor. Everybody's got an Uber tagline. We're no different. You got throw Uber in there, right, to get some validity to it.
We're still trying to work on ours.
I love it. So Uber for the shop floor. So we connect businesses to, you know, flexible capacity for their manufacturing plant. So been doing that since 2016, launched in 2017 and haven't looked back. And then you mentioned Code Story. So I'm a podcast host. I get to interview like-minded tech visionaries. Not that I'm the tech visionary, but the tech individuals who go on and build amazing things like yourself, Rishi.
Yeah, that was a really fun time to spend on your podcast. Thanks for having me there. since you you mentioned about your kind of motivation to start Variable, and it's great. I checked it out, and I think the gig economy overall, and just kind of like enablement marketplaces or two-sided marketplaces in a way, there's an interesting parallel between that and what we're trying to do here at Yield Street. It's interesting that how this is kind of like to segue into the fintech side of things. Almost all of these platforms eventually find their way into some corner of fintech. So for you, of course, it was payments, right? Because obviously when you're an enablement platform, you're doing all the heavy lifting of the logistics and the payment and the cash flows. What are some of the kind of challenges that you faced as you were building, not just of course, the overall platform, but also the money part of it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, from kind of the overall standpoint, we sort of fought with the same things most people fight with, you know, building a prototype, moving fast, debt, things like that. But from a fintech standpoint, from a payments, one thing that I talk about pretty regularly is our daily payouts for our operators, which is what we call the worker side of our platform. Mm-hmm. So early on, we decided, okay, we want to pay these individuals daily. And, you know, we want that to be a huge selling point on our platform. So if a worker comes and works on our platform, the business has till the next day until about 11 a.m. to make adjustments if they were there longer than they plan to be. And then we process their payment and they get paid that next day. So if you can string together a set of, you know, ops for a week or for a month, you essentially have a rolling paycheck. When we started out building this, we went with a well-known, call it the de facto vendor for payments, and started to try to link the collections from the business to the payments to the operators. And it honestly was a nightmare. There was a lot of problems with KYC, with accounts being shut down without us knowing. There was a lot of timing issues of getting the money and then making sure that it got to the workers in time. And it really was just impossible to achieve that daily pay. So we eventually, you know, changed how we looked at it. We broke it into two different processes, collections from our businesses and then payments to our operators, and then integrated some different partners for ACH processing and then for a pay card, and are able to achieve that daily pay now.
You know, and when I hear stories like this, and of course, as part of what we do here at Yield Street, obviously being an investment platform, one of our key parts of our mission is to generate yield for our investor base, especially now. So as we're living in a close to 0% interest rate environment, it's becoming an increasingly important thing for, you know, conscious investors. But I've been doing fintech for, I don't know, coming up on like 20 years now. Jeez, it's crazy to think about it that way. But
you're a veteran.
It's crazy, right? It's if you think about building something like Yield Street or Variable, let's say circa 2004 or 5, it's just, I'm picking that year roughly because that's when that was kind of like my big foray into some real heavy duty fintech back in San Francisco when you're building a wealth management platform. It's amazing how much the ecosystem, the technology ecosystem has evolved since those early days of fintech to where we are today. And if you kind of imagine what it would have been like to build Variable at that point of time, and as opposed to now, despite the attendant challenges, it's amazing how much the world has evolved. And I'd love to get your thoughts on it, but I think like some of the key vectors, if you will, in which the space has evolved has been a lot of emphasis and focus on kind of de-obfuscating necessary, but kind of entrenched in legacy systems kinds of financial services like mortgages or insurance. Now, these are all things that everyone needs, but it used to be an uphill battle back in even as recently as like maybe 10 years ago. But now with companies like, and of course, like along with all of those, the straight up payments and investments part of fintech as well. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely kind of amazing to see all these incredible startups that are coming up in the space that are simplifying these age-old industries that had been mired in paperwork and wet signatures and, like, you know. So this smoothening, the defrictioning, if that's a word, of the overall experience to get access to an essential service has been a big driving force behind a lot of the recent advances in fintech. So I think it probably rings true for you as well as you were building Variable.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting to think back, like you said, when we started Variable, if some of these solutions weren't around or kind of budding, when we started, I don't think it would have been possible to do what we're doing right now. You know, I think that when I look at what's being built across, you know, the fintech world right now, it's like the API-ification of things, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's, well, I guess it's two things really. There's B2C and then there's B2B, right? There's the making financial products, you know, available to consumers that, you know, would have difficulty to get a hold of those services or would have to jump through a bunch of hoops to get them. And then you've got the, you know, the API-ification that I was talking about, the way to you got an API to open a bank account. You got an API to make a trade, you know, on a stock or something, or you got an API to, you know, invest in something different. You know, it really creates this opportunity to abstract, or it is this, it creates the opportunity for developers to abstract a lot of things up and then build stuff on top of it and create new things. I see a lot of similarities, you know, to geek out for a minute, but like as languages progress, right? As languages progress where, you know, you're coding in a much higher abstraction level than flipping ones and zeros, right? Assembly, yeah. All the way up to something we might use today with JavaScript or something like that. So
yeah, it's kind of like the internet pipes did for e-commerce back in the 90s that kind of built the, and in fact, it's a phrase that I've seen used fairly frequently in the space. They call it the financial operating system. So they're really building out the basic building blocks of any kind of company, a product, or any kind of service you want to offer, because it kind of whittles down to some very key basic things: moving money around, verifying identity, or as you mentioned, like trading or selling or buying like securities or instruments. There would be an entire company that would just build that. But now we have a layer of these kind of SaaS type like API platforms that let you do those atomic bits of fintech, so you can actually focus your attention on the actual business problem we are trying to solve. In our case, it's actually opening up. And that's kind of like the other area where I believe fintech is really, really making some interesting strides, especially recently. It is opening up these kind of areas of the financial services world that were kind of hidden, almost unknown, unless you lived on the street, unless you worked on the street, like, you know. And that's actually made possible. Now, if I had to build my own layer over the Nacha protocol to do payment, to do movement of money, it would have taken like twice or thrice as long to build Yield Street as it did. We were able to launch our MVP back in 2015 in like 6 weeks. And it wouldn't have been possible if we had to kind of like go all the way down to that atomic level and build all the plumbing as well. And that's actually an interesting segue because, yes, there are these very cool API companies, and there's any number of those that do payments, that do account opening, that do all of these things that we talked about. But the underlying protocol, if you dig one level deeper below the API, you're still dealing with COBOL and mainframes and technology that was built in the 70s. And I'm sure you remember, and some of our listeners here probably remember as well, there was a outage at the Fed last week, where the ACH system went down. And no matter how beautiful and beautifully versioned and efficient your API is, if that substrate is down, there's absolutely nothing you can do. So I'm curious to hear your take on like, okay, fine, we have commoditized the APIs. That has enabled us to solve problems that would have taken a lot longer to solve a few years ago. But still, if we have this semi-brittle substrate that is decades old, how big of a challenge do you think that is? And what do we think is the way out of that final mile?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I feel like we're in the middle, right? We're, you know, we started out with the old infrastructure and that was it, right? And now we're building a lot of different solutions in the fintech world that sit on top of that infrastructure. But at some time, the pipes are going to have to be changed, right? Yep. You know, there's going to have to be some overhaul in the house, right? I mean, I'm in the, you know, the middle, or I finished some house projects here recently, and just going through that process just kind of helps me think about like how important the foundational elements are to a system. And I see it, I don't know, I see it in two ways. Like the middle part where we are right now, we've got all this cool tech being built on top, and that's good, right? We're abstracting out some of the, you know, commoditizing some of the things that were really hard to do before. But that abstraction, when you talk about code, at the end of the day, it's still going down to ones and zeros, right? We haven't changed ones and zeros. We may have changed how we process. We may have changed, you know, the types of hardware and stuff that process ones and zeros, but it all goes down to ones and zeros. However, you know, the ACH network or EDI or anything like that, some of the older stuff is still not ones and zeros. It's an older abstraction above. You know, you mentioned mainframe and COBOL, like some AS400 sitting around collecting dust that's still processing our ACH payments today. Yeah. So, you know, I think there is a way forward, but it's going to take a lot. And I think when we get there, it's probably going to be a little painful. It's going to take some investment, I think, by the individuals building the new solutions. It's going to take some investment from people maintaining, you know, the ACH network, the EDI protocols, and kind of enabling them to up-level those protocols to newer technology. I think we can get there, but it's probably going to hurt.
You know, it would probably take some concerted effort on the legislative side as well to actually, you know, help this project along. But, you know, there's hope. And just so we, knowing this, knowing the state of the underlying substrate of all of this, we do take care of when we build our solutions on top of this, whether it's an API player or just a product, someone who's building a product like Variable or Yield Street, we are aware of those. So it is actually a big part of an architectural, it's a big architectural consideration when we build these systems, because now we have really, really advanced tool chains to build our software on top of. So knowing that X can go down or Y can go down, we actually spend more time building tolerance to that, building, insulating ourselves from the possibility that something may go down, knowing that no data will be lost. And yeah, maybe there will be a slight delay in getting this or that, but everything will get processed. But you're right. I mean, I think it's going to take a pretty formidable, not undoable, but a formidable level of willpower across multiple parties and institutions and collectives and alliances to actually overhaul this. And I remember I was doing a little bit of work in digital health before I was here at Hill Street, and we had to deal with this on the EDI side, where, you know, processing insurance claims or actually being able to submit health insurance claims and being able to check on the status of those. Now that goes to this low-level EDI protocol. There's companies that have built APIs on top of that, but still, you know, it has the same level of brittleness that we're talking about here with Nacha and similar things. So there is actually upgrading the protocols. What do you think is, and at some point you knew the conversation was going to come around to the B word, right?
I know where you're going.
So, you know, there's a lot being written every day. There are entire companies obviously devoted to building things on top of the blockchain. Do you think that could be one of the possible ways to... So there's two ways, right? You either fix the protocol or you just abandon it altogether and build something new to achieve the same end. Mm-hmm. So what's your... how bullish or not are you on that as a technology? And it'd be an interesting conversation, I think.
Yeah, no doubt. So I really like the blockchain. I'm really dig it. I dig the technology. I dig the idea of the decentralization and the security aspect of it. And everybody's got a copy of the ledger, and, you know, at the very, obviously the very simplest form. But is it a replacement for what we have today? I don't know. You know, I'm still like the guy sitting on the fence looking at all this happening going, I don't know where it's all going to land. I already see very functional use cases for the blockchain, for cryptocurrencies around supply chain, you know, around perhaps even like, you know, real-time currency conversion, stuff like that. I could tokenization of different things. I can totally see that. Yeah. Being applicable now. But as far as taking our old network and up-leveling it or connecting blockchain to that or replacing it, I don't know yet. I have a hard time with that. One thing is because, you know, the way that we've wrapped everything around these systems is it's in a validated state, right? It's in a a state of like, this has been tested, this has been proven. If we change it, we have to revalidate it. You know, I come from when I worked at Alcon Laboratories, and it was an FDA regulated industry. So, you know, audited, and we had to validate all of our systems on the shop floor. So I'm very familiar with that aspect of it. When I think about it from from that to the blockchain, I can picture some of my colleagues at Alcon just their head exploding that wouldn't be possible, because you can't validate it, you can't audit it. Maybe you can, but it's very different. It's a very different mindset. So, how bullish am I? I don't think it's going away. I think it's going to find its place, but I don't know where that place is yet.
And there may be multiple. Like we have, from my perspective, like there is a strong signal and there is a lot of noise around it as well. There are many, I've read so many blockchain white papers that, you know, some of them look like, okay, well, that's a very fascinating use. I mean, I'm not even talking about current cryptocurrencies or which is one particular application of the that can be built on the blockchain, but others tend to look like, I mean, I find myself asking like, okay, well, blockchain can solve it. Is it actually making something easier? Is it really making something cheaper, more efficient? Because otherwise it's a solution looking for a problem. Like, okay, I can solve it with a well-sharded distributed database, and what's the difference, right?
Right.
But there are, speaking of like the asset management space or the kind of the world that we live in Yale Street, we have without going into a lot of detail, we do have a strong point of view on what parts of that world can be simplified. Because, you know, there are certain use cases that are just off limits for blockchain. If you use anything like take HFT, like you can't do high frequency trading in the blockchain because it's the opposite of fast, right? And it's also not the best thing for the environment. But there are so many kind of, we were talking about these archaic systems. There's also archaic processes that can be simplified dramatically. Like by processes, I mean, like, you know, there's multiple parties and counterparties and documents to be signed. And there are still industries, take the IRA industry, we're still faxing things around, right? So there are some very interesting use cases for kind of disintermediating in some of these complex flows and actually having that permanent record, having the distributed ledger be that source of truth rather than a bunch of paper sitting in files somewhere. So that there is that saves costs, that simplifies things, speeds things up, of course, by speeding things up, we're cutting down weeks to hours, not, you know, milliseconds to nanoseconds, a different kind of speed up. But there is also some other interesting angles where it's relatively, and this is a hypothesis, but it's a relatively simpler path to going global, for instance, where you're not, you're dealing with a global currency, the token or whatever the tokenization is that you're following. So you don't have to deal with fiat necessarily, except. So there's some interesting, and I'm kind of with you, like, you know, there are some problems that I think can be effectively solved and have been solved. We know some really good companies that are friends of ours that have built some really good solutions on the blockchain, like Provenance. But yeah, I mean, replacing entirely these old protocols, it's going to take more than one tech. I think you're right. So what role the blockchain can play in it remains to be seen. But so I think one thing you touched upon, audits, that's the other kind of like complexity and challenge that we have to work with when we live in this kind of regulated industry. It's, you know, people talk about building a very simple MVP that for launch, but there are certain corners that we cannot cut when we build an MVP, because they have to be privacy minded, security minded, encryption minded, right from day zero. Even if even if the feature footprint of your MVP is small, you're still going really deep in terms of these privacy and security features. And I'm pretty sure you kind of encountered that with your payments functionality as well. We're coming up on about half an hour. Let's see if you have any questions that have come in. Noah, there's a question for you. Are you worried about the proposed various state level legislation targeted towards the gig economy orgs, very much like variable?
Sure. No, that's a great question. We keep our finger on the pulse of labor law, of legislation, you know, very regularly. We stay in touch with those topics. You know, it's it's an interesting time we live in with the gig economy sort of booming, sort of growing a lot. And at the same time, our labor law is pretty antiquated. So it's going to be interesting to see where it goes. Are we worried about it? We're optimistic about it. We think it's going to turn out well for the gig economy. We think that it's going to be okay. But I do think it's something that we're going to have to pay close attention to always, because we're a marketplace with contractors. And so it's a great question and something I wish I knew where it was going to go, because then I can answer that more definitively. But it's definitely something we keep our finger on the pulse of.
To piggyback on that, that is a very good question. And especially with the proliferation of these kind of gig economy services and products that are coming up, do you think the marketplace itself will be able to influence to some extent the legislation that drives how these platforms function?
I think so. Honestly, I do. And you say the marketplace, and I'll say the marketplaces in my answer, right? The joint community of people who've built these marketplaces that people survive on. And they have a good thing going with the current setup. Now, will there be some things that we probably have to find a middle ground on? Absolutely. But I do think there will be some conversations or some seats at the table for the marketplaces to come in and you know, express what essentially the workers are wanting from what we see.
Yeah, it's going to be regulation and legislation is something that we constantly work with, work through, work alongside with. It's a very strong function here at Yield Street, of course. But I think if there is enough of a critical mass of desire, let's say, and a number of these marketplaces that are looking to kind of like influence the direction in which these things are going, I think they certainly should have a say or have a role or have a voice in the legislation that shapes them.
Absolutely.
I think it'll be good. So we kind of covered how far we've come, what are some of the challenges in building these kinds of products and working with these archaic systems. What's next? What innovations? Obviously, this is kind of a crystal ball look at what remains untapped that would do well to be tapped, let's say. What do you think?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that we got to start planning for change in the pipes. I think we got to start thinking about that. As far as what else could be built on top of the current pipes, I'm sure there are areas in fintech that are not touched yet. Mm-hmm. That are still a bit of a longer manual process, more paperwork driven or more, manual digital process than something, something else. So I know there's areas that can be touched there. And I know there's a ton of areas that could use technology as well. Could use technical extraction on top of older systems. I think you mentioned healthcare records earlier, and some of the auto industry stuff I think could be done too. And there's a lot of older tech that's sitting on. So, but then once we do that, we're going to have to plan to change the pipes. So I know we're going to have to get there. So I know we've got to start thinking about it now.
Yeah, I know a question just come in, which is very interesting and kind of related, and I'll get to it in 1 second. But I think it's kind of useful to look at our day-to-day lives and think of what is still painful, what leaves you wishing that, hey, I wish I had an app that did it. A friend of mine just kind of closed on a house, and the mortgage part has been increasingly made smooth, the financial part of buying a house, but there's all the other stuff, dealing with the brokers, all the paperwork, the inspections and stuff like that. Now, wouldn't it be cool? This is just kind of one idea where wouldn't it be cool if there was a single platform that did all of it, the finance side of it, getting the mortgage, doing the inspections, all of that. Hey, maybe there is an interesting use case for blockchain. Everything, all the documents just sit on the chain, and everyone who needs access to them has access to them. I think that's a good way to think of what's next. What is painful right now? Because some of the best ideas come from addressing a known pain point, what do we think when the regulation is going to catch up? And when it does, is it going to be good or bad for this industry? So, Noah, you can take that. I think it's kind of related so there's two related but slightly different industries. So if you want to take that for the gig economy, and I can kind of address it from the asset management standpoint.
Sure, sure. Yeah, from a gig economy standpoint, I mean, I think the regulation is going to catch up. I think that when it's going to catch up, I think it's probably sooner than later. You know, I think if you look at like AB5, Prop 22 stuff that's been going on in California, and then, you know, some of the other states having conversations as well, and then the federal government getting involved, I think it's becoming more of a topic because gig economy is becoming more of a pillar in the economy. So I think they're going to catch up real soon. And I think that if it's good or bad, it remains to be seen. I think that I'm optimistic that it's going to be good, and I'm optimistic that our leaders are going to try to put together something that's best for everybody. I think that the best solution in our eyes, and you know, this is where I sit, is to continue to make gig economy or keep gig economy a contractor type status, and then, you know, have employment laws that fit actual employment scenarios. But I'm not sure what it's going to be when it gets there, but I'm hopeful and optimistic that we can come to something that's going to work for everybody.
I think all of the news and the whole narrative of Uber, you said it's Uber for manufacturing, like the treatment of the drivers, like the operators in Uber, like, you know, how should they be handled? I think that's actually raised a lot of these important, very important questions about, you know, the role of regulation. Who does it help? Who does it hurt? Of course, speaking for Yield Street, we are already regulated up the wazoo, and for all the right reasons. From day one, some of the earliest hires that we had in the company were lawyers, you know, and compliance specialists, and who every day make sure that everything we do, all the offerings, all the processes, down to what we say in our marketing materials and tweets and stuff like that is very, very well controlled, and it should be. Sometimes the regulation helps us, you know, or changes in regulation help us. Recently, the SEC relaxed the time period on accreditation verification, which is great because it's a big friction point, right? Every year you have to renew your or re-verify your accreditation status. And very soon, you won't have to do it every year. You only have to do it every 5 years, which is great for us, great for, and most importantly, it's great for our investors. So they have to go through this process over and over. I think I got the signal. So I'd love to kind of wrap up a little bit. Thanks for all the questions. And I really hope you enjoyed our chat here. Please feel free to send us feedback on what else we can talk about. And we certainly take every recommendation and suggestion into account. Noah, thanks a lot for joining us today. This was awesome. And I hope we'll keep continue chatting over the years. I think there's a lot of interesting build still left in our space, and I look forward to kind of chatting more about that. Thanks again, everyone, for joining. Just to kind of reiterate, please visit www.yieldstreet.com to know more about our offerings. We have a few that are on open right now, including one that launched just about a little over half an hour ago. If you're an originator looking to raise some capital through our investor network, please email us at originations@yieldstreet.com. And also, we have mobile apps both for Android and iOS. So do download those and tell us what you think. Thank you again. And thanks, Noah, again, for being here.
Thanks, Rishi. Honor.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street.
trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.